You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sackstein.
Good afternoon and welcome to Soul to Soul. It's lovely to be with you this beautiful Wednesday afternoon here from our studios in Johannesburg. And we are continuing with our crash course in Jewish history. We're finishing off our series today, so we have a lot of material to cover. But I figured that covering the history of the Jewish people, as we have done for the last number of weeks, it wouldn't be correct to end off on a high note and probably the greatest event happening to the Jewish people in the last 100 years, and that is the declaration of the State of Israel in 1948. So let's conclude our series. Of course, we've reached last week we got to World War II and the State of Israel. And as I mentioned last week, there's not enough hours in the day to talk about the Holocaust and about the great tragedy of the destruction of European Jewry. And we don't understand and we don't have answers and we have such great pain from our loss at that time. But from the ashes came a light and came a building and came hope for the Jewish people after World War II. So we're going to be discussing today the miraculous events leading up to the establishment of the State of Israel. And it's very important for all of the Jewish people to remember and know and have the facts clear as to the events leading up to the establishment of the State of Israel. Because unfortunately, we've seen many of those facts changed and distorted in order to suit certain agendas and certain points of view. And so I hope that with our time together, it will be beneficial for us to go through the amazing events that took place and the many different aspects and situations that had to be perfect in order for the State of Israel to come into being. And we call that Hashkocha, Hashem's hand, God's hand, guiding the events of history in order for certain outcomes to result. So let's pick up from where we left off in terms of, we did mention last time that Britain takes over control of Palestine from the Ottoman Empire. We already have the Zionist movement gaining momentum, Herzl holding the first Zionist Congress in 1897. In 1917 is the Balfour Declaration, where the British government says they're in favor of a Jewish state, and those sentiments were confirmed in the 1919 Treaty of Versailles after World War I. Britain, in order, during the time of the Mandate, in order to placate the Arabs, Britain split the Mandate into two. In 1921, the eastern part was given to the Arabs, was called Transjordan, or the kingdom of the Hashemite kingdom of Abdullah, which is what is Jordan today, was created and established by the British. And the British hoped to satisfy and to placate the Arabs after giving them Jordan, but that was not very successful. And the entire period of the Mandate was filled with violence. The Arab population rioted on the regular basis. The Jewish groups were formed because it was apparent that the British were now reneging on the promise of the Balfour Declaration and the Treaty of Versailles. And so the situation is not simple for the British, who are controlling the area of Palestine. After World War II, so England is very weak. England was bled dry by the war, and their hopes of maintaining the empire were futile. They realized that after World War II. And they came to terms with the fact that they'd had to give up India as well. And if Britain had to give up India, there was little reason for them to maintain a strong defense of the Suez Canal. The main reason for the defense of the Suez Canal was in order that they would have quick access and be able to defend India. But nevertheless, a power that is accustomed to being a major imperialistic empire, as England was, finds it difficult to walk away from the world stage gracefully. And therefore, England still pursued their policies to protect her interests in the Middle East. Now, after World War II, what were the British interests? British interests were oil. There were English oil companies that had major holdings in Iraq and in Saudi Arabia. Later, these holdings were replaced by U.S. companies. And since the basis of the world economy after World War II was based on oil, it remained strategically necessary for England to maintain herself and protect her oil interests in the Middle East. We see that in Britain, one of the great acts of ingratitude was when the British public voted Churchill out of power, and they voted in a Labour government under Clement Attlee, and Attlee appointed as his foreign secretary Ernest Bevin, who was an open anti-Semite. Again, we see God's hand. I'm going to try and come back to this point as we discuss the facts, the situations as they unfolded, one of them significantly being that Churchill was no longer Prime Minister of Britain. Because if Churchill was Prime Minister of Britain, it's very unlikely that we would have a Jewish state today. Why? Because Churchill was very favorable towards the Jews and towards the Jewish dream of having an independent state. And there's no question that Churchill would have come to an accommodation and a compromise with the Jewish people. And then the point wouldn't have had to go to a head. But since there was Attlee and Bevin as his foreign secretary, so they were against the Jews. They had they were not interested in coming to any agreement and compromise, and therefore it brought the point to a head, and that resulted in the state being founded. So if Churchill was the Prime Minister, that's another act of God, God's hand in the whole situation over here, that Churchill wasn't the Prime Minister at the time. We also have the other major world player at the time, the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union emerged from World War II, even though they incurred severe losses. 20 million Russians died in World War II, but nonetheless, it emerged as one of the great empires in Europe after World War II. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sackstein.
After World War II, Russia was one of the great powers in the world, certainly the dominant power in Europe. And under Stalin, Russia controlled a third of Germany, Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Hungary, Romania, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria. Russia was a very powerful state, had these nine satellites, was an enormous empire with enormous resources and a dictator running it. Russia always had its eye on the Middle East, and Russia wanted to be a Middle Eastern power. It was blocked by Turkey and Iran in the south. We see England on the one side is backed by the United States. We have Russia on the other side. And we have this new organization that was created after World War II called the United Nations. But by definition, an organization of nations is imperfect. And the United Nations had a Security Council, was run by the five great world powers: China, France, England, United States, and Russia. Russia had a veto, so nothing effective could really take place from the UN unless Russia and the four other powers came to agreement. Into this mix, we have the question of Palestine, of Israel. There are 250,000 survivors of Hitler's death camps, and they're placed in DP camps, displaced person camps, which is a euphemism for refugees. And most of the camps were in Germany or nearby in Central Europe. There was a big question, what to do with these people? None of them wanted to go back to Eastern Europe, certainly not under communism. And some of them went to Poland. About 5,000 Jews after World War II returned to Poland. There were immediately pogroms, and hundreds of Jews were killed. The Poles made it clear that they didn't want the Jews to come back. And they had nowhere to go. They took a poll amongst the refugees in the DP camps. The majority said they wanted to go to Palestine. The United States was willing to accept some of them, but not 250,000. And therefore, President Truman in 1946 asked Ernest Bevin, the British Foreign Secretary, to allow 100,000 Jewish refugees into Palestine. Bevin answered, he said he wants to send them to Palestine because he doesn't want them in New York. So England refused to make any accommodation regarding the issue of refugees, and it became a major issue in the world. In order for England to maintain a hold of the country was chaotic, and the Jews wanted their state, the Arabs wanted their state and didn't want the Jews, the British were trying to maintain peace, but they didn't have a sufficient hold of the situation. And they knew that they needed another 50 to 80,000 soldiers in order to stabilize, and they couldn't afford it. England believed that the chaos actually was to her benefit, because the sides would beg England to stay in order to impose some order in the country. The British were convinced that the Jews would beg them to stay because the Arabs were the majority and the Arab armies were massed on the borders. So it would be obvious that the Jews would be overrun and destroyed. And therefore, the only hope for the Jews would be for England to stay and to protect them. And if the Jews asked England to stay, so that would be the end of Zionism, because they would stay only if no more immigration would be allowed and there would be no hope for a Jewish state. So that's how the British saw it, and that's how the British read the situation. The Russians also had their plans. From the end of World War II till 1947, the Russians didn't say anything about Zionism. And we know the Russians wanted to get into the Middle East, whether through the Arabs or through the Jews, didn't bother them either way. And the communist government had always up to then been very anti-Zionist. We know from Menachem Begin's famous book, White Nights, he describes how anti-Zionist the communist regime was. Begin was in the Polish army when Russia invaded in September 1939, and the Polish army was sent to Siberia. When the Russians were attacked by the Germans, the British insisted that the Polish army be freed and join the fight against the Germans. And they did. They fought in Italy and other places. Begin went AWOL and he walked to Palestine. When he arrived in Palestine as a disciple of Jabotinsky, he took over the Irgun when David Razel died and he initiated the struggle against the British. So England felt that the Russians would never support Zionism and the Zionistic aspirations of the Jewish people. And the British understood that Zionism went against the communist Shulchan Aruch, the communist manifesto of Karl Marx, that Zionism was something that the communists couldn't tolerate. The British knew that, but it was a major calculation on their part. In fact, we see everybody miscalculated over here. And again, we see God's hand in orchestrating the events. The English made a dramatic gesture. They said that we have this organization called the United Nations. And this organization, the United Nations, is supposed to solve the world's problems. So we're going to hand this problem over to the United Nations. And this is what later we've seen the cabinet meeting minutes. And we understand now what the British thought process was. So I'll quote to you directly from the words of Bevan in the cabinet meeting. He said, "Look at the United Nations Charter and then look at the nations belonging to it. In order to obtain a favorable decision for partition, the Jews will need 2/3 of the vote in the General Assembly. They will only be able to obtain it if the Western and Eastern blocs will both support the decision and the implementation of the resolution. Nothing like this has ever happened. It can't happen. It will never happen." So the British foreign policy was based on the premise that giving this issue over to the UN would create another impasse and there would be such chaos in the country. The only situation would be for Britain to please come and save the day and create peace and implement some law and order. The US would then give the British the money to send in another 50,000 troops. England will remain with the mandate and its position will be strengthened. The chaos, and because of the chaos, the Balfour Declaration would prove to be impossible. Britain will stay and protect its oil interests and maintain a vestige of its imperial greatness. That was the view of the British, and that's how they approached the situation. Stalin played both sides as always. Stalin was led to believe that the Israeli Communist Party was very strong. And he also knew that the Labour Party, which was the dominant political party in the country, was staunchly socialistic. And he therefore felt that if a Jewish state arose, not that the Communist Party would win the election, but that they would do the same in Israel as they did in Czechoslovakia. There would be enough communists in the government who would then stage a coup, and they would take over the government, and Russia then would have a foothold smack right in the Middle East. And the majority, many in Israel actually thought this to be the case. To Ben-Gurion's everlasting credit, when the state was declared and the War of Independence broke out, so Ben-Gurion formed a wall-to-wall coalition of all the political parties, save one, the Communist Party. because he knew that once the bear's in the house, it's very difficult to get it out. He smelt the Trojan horse, which was a very smart political move on his part. So the Russians therefore played the Jewish card, and they indicated to the Zionist movement that they would support the Jewish state. And they also played the Arab card, and because they wanted the oil, but they mainly wanted England out of the Middle East, and with England out, they would fill that vacuum. Enters the United States. The United States was the major world power after World War II. The United States had the monopoly on nuclear weapons, had the largest industrial base, the largest economy. Out of all the major powers, suffered the least citizens killed in the war. Although 600,000 American soldiers were killed, that's compared to millions of the European countries, so it was a small number, relatively speaking. And they didn't suffer any destruction to their territory. England had the Blitz, Germany was bombed out, France, Russia were almost destroyed. The U.S. suffered much less, and the U.S. now had a new president, with the death of Roosevelt in April 45. That president was Harry Truman. Truman was a very unlikely president. Only lately has American politics looked very closely and scrutinized the vice president, in the thought that maybe if the president is removed from office or if passes away, the vice president would have taken. But back then, the vice president was nobody really took much care or notice of the vice president. And so you have Truman, who was a senator from Missouri. He ran a committee in World War II that was against corruption, so he appeared to be above corruption. And suddenly he's thrust into the position of President of the United States with Roosevelt's death in April 45. Again, another incredible act of hashkocha, of God's providence at the time, is that if Roosevelt was still the President of the United States, it's pretty certain that we wouldn't have a Jewish state too. Although the Jews loved Roosevelt, only later has it become clear that Roosevelt was not very good for the Jews. So we see God's hand at play throughout. Truman gets involved in the Cold War. The State Department was always anti-Zionist, if not anti-Semitic, and was of the opinion that it could control Truman and run his foreign policy. It would oppose any Jewish homeland because it's against American interests. American interests, again, were oil, and to sustain the oil, England owed the United States so much money from World War II that it wasn't able to pay their debts, and gradually the United States took over the British oil companies. So it was important that none of that would be jeopardized. So it was decided that the United Nations would make a special committee on Palestine to decide what to do. That was called UNSCOP, the United Nations Special Commission on Palestine, or Special Committee on Palestine. England hoped that the UN would say the British mandate should stay. The Russians hoped that Britain would be step out and they would fill the vacuum. The United States wasn't sure what it wanted in Palestine. UNSCOP was composed of a number of different nations, 11 various nations, and the committee was constructed in such a way that no decision would be reached. And that was part of the plan. That was what England wanted, and that's why they were so willing to hand it over to the UN. And therefore, the Britain said they would accept any recommendation that UNSCOP would make. Little did they know that UNSCOP would come out with a strong recommendation. There were many factors that influenced the decision, one of them being the refugees. There was, was the situation with the Exodus, which was a famous ship in 1947 that had 4,500 Jewish passengers on it. It was an old ferry from the United States that really had a capacity of 1,200, almost four times its capacity. It was carrying refugees out of Europe to try and get to Palestine. The British caught it, make it through the British blockade, and the British took it to Haifa Harbor, and they sent the ship back to Germany, to the port in Hamburg. Such was the arrogance of the British. They didn't even send them back to a neutral port. They sent them back to Germany. You believe such a thing after the Holocaust. And people died on the ship. People were killed by the British. From this incident grew the novel of Leon Uris, famous novel Exodus 1947. The movie came out. So this was a public relations battle that for once was won by the Jews. I think so ever since then we haven't won the public relations war. But back then it certainly was it was an incident, and generally the situation of the refugees was a plight that was used by the Jewish cause in order to gain sympathy from the people around the world. UNSCAP voted. It was a very close vote, but it came in favor of partition, and now it was sent to the General Assembly. And Russia's position, of course, was very significant, because we actually see today, with the opening up of the archives, what the thought process of the Russian government was at the time. And they said that if they supported the Arabs, they'd have an Arab country that was poor, with no economic basis. They were stuck with fundamental Muslim ideas. Better to have a Jewish country that will be rich and powerful, and we will be able to subvert it from within. Rather, we take over a wealthy country than we take over a poor country. Because if it's a poor country, we're going to have to supply it with materials, with arms, and it'll be a drain on our resources. Let's rather take over a rich country, which will be a basic ally for us in the Middle East. So that was the idea that was believed by the Russian Foreign Office. They therefore signaled that they would support partition to UNSCAP. And partition meant the supporting of a Jewish state and an Arab state, one next to the other. And this became known to the world in May 1947. Andrei Gromyko, who was the representative of Russia at the United Nations, said that my government endorses the aspirations of the Jewish people to establish a state. Everyone was shocked. They couldn't believe it. He said that no Western country succeeded in protecting the elementary rights of the Jewish people, and therefore my government will support partition. And that changed the whole picture, because the Soviet Union wasn't one vote alone. The Soviet Union was also Ukraine and Belarus. And as well as that, on top of this, so that's three. And then we have Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia that also went with it. So we're talking about eight votes. And with those eight votes, for the first time, the Zionist movement saw it was possible to get the two-thirds majority in the United Nations General Assembly. The U.S. was pivotal in the issue. Truman and the State Department were split. The General George Marshall, who was the Secretary of State, he was one of the great heroes of World War II. He oversaw the training and the armament of the U.S. Army. He was a very talented, capable person. Marshall said to Truman, if you support a Jewish state, I will resign as Secretary of State and I will campaign against you in the 1948 presidential elections. Truman was an interesting individual. Truman didn't like to be told what to do. He described himself as a stubborn Missouri farmer. And when Marshall told him that, he says, George, you do what you have to do. I'll do what I have to do. But I would still like to remind you that I am the President of the United States. And so Truman made a commitment to the U.S. Zionist movement that he would support partition. And the Zionist movement worked very hard to get as many votes as possible on the big and fateful day. And they used all means possible to try and win over their votes. And so on November the 29th, 1947, the day of reckoning was when the United Nations General Assembly voted for or against partition of Palestine. Please join us. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sackstein.
So on November the 29th, 1947, the United Nations General Assembly voted whether they supported partition that was recommended by UNSCAP, the special committee set up with regards to Palestine. In order for the motion to be passed, a two-thirds majority was necessary. The votes took place. 33 were in favor and 13 were against. Today, so the two-thirds majority was incredibly achieved. Today, you know, we'd struggle to get two votes, never mind two-thirds in the United Nations. But it's just an incredible situation that there was a strong momentum, and it was all against the logic, and it took up the will of everybody. That again, we see Hashem's hand, which was quite incredible. Of the 13 votes that said no, 11 were Muslim countries, and the other two, the two non-Muslim countries that voted no, were Cuba and Greece. The partition plan is therefore passed, and now the borders need to be drawn. Jerusalem is designated as an international city. Arabs are given the majority of the country in the partition plan. The only large portion was given to the Jews. It was the Negev, because it was considered worthless land and unable to be developed. The Arab section had a population of 804,000 Arabs, 15,000 Jews. The Jewish section had a population of 600,000 Jews and 130,000 Arabs. Bleyan Hora today, we've more than 10 times the population, the Jewish population in Israel is more than 6 million. Bleyan Hora, Vecheni, Yerbu, so it should increase. The Jews accepted the partition plan because, as Rav Herzog said, who was the chief rabbi, the first chief rabbi of Israel, he said, we will take whatever we can and we will build from there. The Arabs rejected the plan. And this is the crucial point. It became an existential issue, not a territorial issue. The Arabs rejected the idea of a Jewish state. It wasn't the issue of where to draw the borders and how can we come to the right agreement in terms of the territory. The issue for the Arabs was the existence of a Jewish state, and that could not be tolerated. And that's the great mistake that all Arab leadership has made since then and even till today, rejected the proposal or the potential of a Jewish state. And today, the war began, the war therefore began, and it really hasn't stopped from that point. And there's nothing more that Israel wants than peace. And unfortunately, Israel doesn't have a genuine peace partner to talk to on the other side of the table. So the War of Independence didn't begin in May the 15th, 1948. It really began on November the 30th, 1947, and has continued ever since, unfortunately. The British took an openly pro-Arab position, and from the time of when partition was approved, from November 47, and they armed the Arabs, they supported them diplomatically, and they felt that the greater, even if there was continued unrest and turmoil, so they would still be asked by the world, by the Jews, by the United Nations, to step in and to restore order. We had the Irgun and the retaliatory strikes of the Irgun against the British, and so the situation was chaotic. The British armed the Arab Legion. They had a British officer called Ghalib Pasha, who was John Baggett Ghalib, who was the leader of the Arab Legion. The British armed the biggest army in the Middle East, the Egyptian army. The British armed the Iraqi army and allowed them to come through Transjordan. So we see that the British were trying to fuel the flames and very much sided with the Arabs. The Zionists made one last attempt to come to an agreement, and they met with the leader of the Arab world it wasn't called the Arab League in those days, but it's equivalent of the Arab League today. They secretly met him in New York, and they said that they're prepared to make territorial concessions, prepared to make commitments and cooperation economically with the Arabs, as long as they can work together and build a peaceful place for both peoples to live in peace side by side. And that individual told them, he said, if I make an agreement with you, if I sign a treaty with you, when I get back home, I'm going to be killed. I'll be killed. He said no Arab leader could agree to the existence of the Jewish state, and all talking is futile. The matter will only be decided by force. That's what he said back then, and unfortunately that's what the situation is still today. We see any Arab leaders that are brave enough to make agreements and to settle for peace with Israel get assassinated. That's what happened to Sadat after the Camp David Accords with Menachem Begin in 1978. He was soon after assassinated. And unfortunately, we shouldn't be fooled by the bias in the liberal media. Israel very much wants to come to a resolution, very much wants to make peace. But unfortunately, there's no equal desire for peace on the other side. Because as long as the Arab world cannot accept the existence of Israel, of course there'll never be peace. And the reason for that is because it's not a political struggle. It's a theological struggle. And within the basic tenets of Islam is a land that was controlled by Muslims cannot be controlled by infidels. Israel, which was controlled by the Ottoman Empire for a number of centuries, so it's an insult to Islam for Israel to now be controlled by Jews. And therefore, no Muslim could accept the situation as it is and needs to constantly oppose it and fight against it. And that's why we constantly have the impasse and we have the situation we have with war from November 1947 to August 2018. There's a constant attempt to remove any Jewish control of the land of Israel and to destroy the independence of the land of Israel. So unfortunately, that's the reality that we all face, and we pray for peace, but we have to realize what the situation is and deal with it accordingly. What happened then was Truman saw the turmoil and saw how bitter the war was, as soon as the partition was approved, and he began to have second thoughts. He instructed the United States representative at the UN to come up with a new plan. The new plan was that we could see partition is not workable, and therefore let's try something else called trusteeship, in which the United Nations would become the mandatory power, and hopefully that would bring peace to the region. Russia opposed it. They wanted the war because they wanted the British out. The British opposed it because they wanted to be asked to keep the peace. United, so the plan went nowhere. But since it was proposed by the American delegation, it made, obviously, the Jews and the Zionist movement very uncomfortable. The Zionist movement tried to reach Truman, but he said he didn't want to see anybody. He felt he was being pressurized from all sides, and he wouldn't allow anybody to get to him. Now, this is where another fascinating part of the story kicks in which Truman, again, we see God's hand at play. Truman had a very good friend, and a very good friend of his was a Jew by the name of Eddie Jacobson. Truman and Eddie Jacobson had a haberdashery store in Kansas City in the early 20s. The store went bankrupt before Truman went into politics. And although Jacobson was an assimilated Jew, he still nonetheless was a Jew. We see at that time there was a tremendous feeling amongst the Jewish people, even if they were not observant Jews or they were very assimilated Jews, that every Jew had to step forward and try and do what they could for the Jewish people, because after the Holocaust, every Jew saw what could happen in the exile and how vulnerable Jews are, how important it was that we play a role to try and establish and create the State of Israel. We see, interestingly enough, Golda Meir went to America to raise money for the War of Independence. She met with Jews that were part of the Mafia. They gave her paper bags with cash in them. We know that Hank Greenspan in Los Angeles took apart three B-17 bombers and shipped them piece by piece to Israel because there was an arms embargo. He couldn't send arms. He was later arrested and went to jail for it. But there was a sense of Jews to, each Jew should play their part and do what they can on behalf of the Jewish people. Please stay with us. We'll continue when we're back with a fascinating story of Eddie Jacobson and his friend President Truman.
You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sackstein.
So the Zionist movement approaches Eddie Jacobson and they say, Eddie, there's no way we can get to Truman. He's blocking us out. We need your help. He said, what do you want from me? He said, please meet, go see President Truman and ask him to give a small amount of time for a meeting with Dr. Chaim Weizmann. Now, Weizmann had been sidelined by Ben-Gurion and by the American Zionists. They felt he was too old, that he was obsolete. He was almost blind already. They felt he was too close to the English. But they realized that Weizmann would be the only one who would have the ability to convince Truman. And so Jacobson goes to see his old friend. And, of course, he gets let into the Oval Office. And Truman says, Eddie, my friend, what can I do for you? And he said, Mr. President, I have one favor to ask. I'm really sorry to do this. I apologize from the outset, but please will you meet with Dr. Weizmann for a few short minutes? And he said it will make a big difference. Apparently, Truman writes in his biography that, it's written in all the biographies of Truman, that Truman was extremely angry at that point, and he cursed, and he said, they got to you, and I told them not to exert put pressure on me. But he said, Eddie, my old friend, I can't say no, I have to do it. I'll meet with him. And that short meeting with Weizmann turned into a meeting for 1.5 hours. And Truman was extremely impressed with Weizmann. He was impressed with Weizmann's sincerity, was impressed with the case presented by Weizmann. And he told the State Department after that meeting that we're withdrawing the idea of trusteeship and we're going back to supporting the partition. And he said there's going to be a Jewish state and the United States will support the establishment of the Jewish state. Our sages teach us, Ein lecha adam she'ein lo shah. There's no person who doesn't have their moment. Each of us has an important pinnacle moment in our lives, an opportunity to do something for the Jewish people, an opportunity to make a difference. And that certainly was Eddie Jacobson's moment. He could have said, sorry, I don't want to jeopardize my relationship with the president. I don't want to go there because it's not going to be healthy. Could have said, I'm busy, I'm tired, the usual excuses. But no, he stood up to the task and he made that opening and it made a massive difference. Truman remained a loyal supporter and he pursued it right until the end. Now that partition is in place, what are the Jews going to do with it? The English finally announced after delaying, on purpose, deliberately delaying, they finally announced that they would leave the mandate on May the 14th, 1948. And there was great disagreement amongst the Zionist leaders whether or not to establish the state. We see that General Marshall, he sent a letter to Charette, who was like the foreign minister, saying, don't declare the state and we're going to make a plan and we'll protect you and it'll be a disaster. But Ben-Gurion was a very strong person and Ben-Gurion pushed it through. He took it to a vote, which was vote 6-4 in favor of declaring the state. And so the state was declared. And immediately the Arab armies invaded and the war was on. Nobody thought the Jewish people had a chance. Even though the revisionist historians say that the Arabs didn't have a chance, but that's false. That's a distortion of the facts. It's a lie. The truth is that the Jews faced overwhelming odds. They were outnumbered both in terms of arms, both in terms of armies. They were a bunch of refugees that had survived the Holocaust against a number of 5 well-trained Arab armies and well-armed Arab armies. The fact that they held out and they succeeded was absolutely miraculous, was just something that is an incredible miracle of our time. So we see time and again God's hand at play in these events, and ultimately the state of Israel is declared, and Israel incredibly maintains itself and survives and wins the war of independence. And the Arabs have never accepted the partition. They've never accepted this existential existence of the state of Israel. And that's really the situation we face today. Nothing much has changed in 70 years. What has changed is that Israel has built itself and Israel has become one of the great wonders of our modern world. Technologically, Israel is way in the front of the pack in terms of its developments and its IT industry. And Israel has rebuilt itself quite incredibly in every respect. It really is a tremendous miracle of our times. And something that we should not take for granted, but be very grateful to Hashem that we have a state of Israel. And please God, the state of Israel should continue to develop and continue to build itself and continue to grow, both in terms of its population, and in terms of its economic power and influence. And please God, we've discussed, it's just amazing in our crash course in Jewish history, what we've been through as a people. And we should, please God, see the positive ending of our journey with the coming of Mashiach and the ultimate redemption, not only for the Jewish people, but for all of humanity. B'mehera b'yameinu. Amen.